We have a fascinating discussion lined up for you guys today. One of the questions we are asked more than any other, despite being a geopolitics platform, is who really controls the world? We've had countless questions about COVID-19, the two world wars, banking, finance, 9/11, and whether there are alternative explanations for some of the biggest events in modern history. And at the same time, the rise of alternative media has led many people to question how power really works. So as part of our Geopolitics 101 series, we thought it was time to tackle this topic. We'll be looking at power, influence, institutions, corporations, and some of the most popular conspiracy theories all through the lens of geopolitics. And joining me today for this discussion is geopolity founder Adnan Khan. Hope you're well, Adnan.
Yeah, I'm doing well, Imran. How are you keeping?
Yes, very well. Trying to stay cool as possible, as much as possible, actually. Hope you're well. Right, so Adnan, this is a massive topic. And before we jump into different theories and ideas, what's the best place to start?
You're absolutely right. This is actually quite a humongous discussion. And this is why, actually, there's a whole industry out there for this. There's a lot of discussion that takes place. And when we look at this, it's really about understanding power. And it's important to understand that wanting to dominate others, wanting to be at the top, is nothing new. It's existed throughout history. It existed in ancient times. So you look at the Romans, you look at the Persians, you go further back to the Egyptians. Dominating over others has always existed, whether it's through empires, whether it's through dynasties, whether it's through conquest. Now, the challenge historically has been, in terms of achieving this, is how do you resource this? If you think before the industrial period, if you wanted to dominate over others, you need huge armies. That requires a lot of wealth, requires resources. You need supporters. So in order to dominate over others, you actually need significant resources. In throughout history, we just never had the technology where you could have a small force which could dominate over many, many other people. Now, wanting to dominate over others has always existed. It's always been the case in history. The challenge has been how do you actually achieve this? And this is what allows us to really understand this topic. Through probably most of human history, conquest was the way how you dominated over others. But there was one big problem with conquest, and that is it comes with a lot of risk. If you lose wars, you lose a lot of wealth, you could then become conquered. So you could set out to be a conqueror, but you end up becoming conquered because of the resources actually needed to do this. Now, technology has actually changed a lot of this. Technology now allows us to control a lot of people. It allows conquest to happen with a much smaller amount of input. There were times when you needed armies in the hundreds of thousands, in the multiple hundreds of thousands. And this was at a time when the population of the world was less than 1 billion. So today we have technology where there are much more efficient ways of actually conquering, of dominating over others. And this context is very important because there's the reason why you want to dominate over others, and then is the how you do it. The how is completely dominated by technology, which I'm sure we're going to cover in this podcast. Why people want to dominate over others, you can see a few things throughout history. People have always wanted power over other people. You've always had power-hungry people. You've had people who are sociopaths. They want to dominate over others. It's always existed. In fact, it's one thing that crosses over race, religion, and ideas. Then you've had control. You've got people who are psychopaths. They want to be able to control others. You've then got ideology. We've seen in the modern era, whether it was the Soviet Union, whether you've had the imperial Europeans, they wanted to conquer other people, they wanted to spread their way of life. And then you've got resources. We saw the Europeans went out and conquered the world, and they stole their resources and abused what there was in terms of wealth in the territories of the world. So a good place, really, when we're looking at this, it's important to understand why people want to do this. There are reasons why people do this, and this goes back throughout history. If we were to chart the whole of history, this has always existed. And the major difference has been is the technology available to do it. If you conquer a whole nation of people, you now got to control them, you got to rule over them, you got to feed them. And in the past, technology just wasn't there in order for you to do that. You needed massive armies, and that is what limited how far you could actually go. And as we go further into this discussion, I'm hoping this will become a lot more obvious of why the resources, the technology is actually a prerequisite in terms of controlling people.
So to understand today's world, many would argue that you have to understand how Europe rose to global dominance in the 15th and 16th centuries. Why was that period so significant, and what changed?
So that period is significant because that was when the awakening of Europe happened. It's when the Enlightenment happened. It's when Europe went from a backwater that believed in superstition. They believed in the divine will of kings. They even believed in magic. This was the sort of thing they believed in. So there was no such thing as science. There was no such thing as thinking productively. And this all changed in the 1500s. It changed when they discovered the Americas. Their ideas about life then changed. And this opened up new opportunities for the Europeans because their thinking about the world fundamentally changed. So countries like Spain, Portugal, the UK or England at the time, Holland, France, Germany, Italy, their situation changed. Now, these nations, they didn't really exist as nation states at that time. What you had was monarchies and dynasties. In the UK, you had monarchies across the... I mean, the UK didn't exist. You had England, you had Scotland, you had the Irish. And even then, amongst them, they were divided. In Spain, they were carrying out a genocide against the Muslims and the Jews. And you had one monarchy who then came to dominate Spain. Holland was multiple territories with princes and kings. The French weren't a unified nation at this point. Germany didn't even exist as a term. And Italy consisted of multiple city-states, which had monarchies and had rich individuals where they had their own kingdoms. So this was really the beginning part of really, in fact, the modern world. In order to understand it, you do need to understand the 14th, 15th century, the awakening, the rise of Europe and the changes they underwent. And these changes really have shaped the world we live in today.
So one of the defining features of Europe's rise was the development of modern banking, credit and financial markets. How important were these innovations in changing the balance of power?
So the rise of finance actually is very central to many of the arguments you're hearing today, many of the conspiracies that you hear today, and actually the role in this evolution is absolutely critical. Now, I mentioned in this era, what you had was loads of estates, lots of kingdoms, princes and monarchies who all used to fight each other. In Italy specifically, you had a number of territories which had their own rulers. And the reason why I mentioned Italy is around the 1300s, an explorer, Marco Polo, he went to China, and he went to China when the Mongols were ruling over it. So we call that the Yuan dynasty. And this was the first time where the Europeans, through Marco Polo, they became aware of a different way of how money works. Now, through all of the human history, money was really gold and silver. So literally, you have minted coins. They had a certain amount of gold and silver in it, and people accepted it. This is why even today, gold is very, very popular as money. Whenever there's a crisis, what do people do? They buy gold. Gold has been money since the beginning of human history. Now, the problem that existed in Europe specifically was the kings and the monarchies, they needed to borrow gold if they wanted to go to war, if they wanted to raise an army. They couldn't print their own money. And the gold and the silver was managed by goldsmiths. It was managed by the bankers of that time, which was usually the goldsmiths. Now, Marco Polo, in his writings, he explained that what happened in China at the time was when you entered China, you'd have to give up what money you've got, and in return, you will get the currency of China. And the currency of China was made from a certain material, and it was signed by the Chinese. It was signed by the emperor. And because the emperor was the leader, you wasn't allowed to use any other money. And that was the only money you were allowed to use. So he literally was the money.
So he could print as much money as he wanted. He could withdraw how much money he wanted. That wasn't what the Europeans did. What you find was the kings and the princes, they'd have to borrow money. They'd have to take a loan. And if they didn't pay back, the bankers or the ghost people would pay or loan somebody else money who would go to war with them. So this was the first time that Europeans heard of another way of issuing money. So the key for you to understand that in Europe, the princes and the kings, the monarchies, they had estates. They inherited the estate from their fathers. But when it came to raising money, all they had was taxes, or more importantly, they'd have to borrow money. They'd have to take a loan. So this was the first time the Europeans come across this idea. And that's why the Italian city-states like Genoa, like the Venetian bankers, they were the first who began doing this. So before, you know, if you're lending gold to a king, you'd have to go and get the gold from somewhere as a goldsmith. What happened in the Yuan dynasty was you had the king. He could print as much as he wanted because he was the money. Because he was the emperor, nobody else had the ability to create money. In Europe, what you find, you had goldsmiths, but the rulers were these monarchs. And these monarchs didn't have the ability to print money, so they'd have to actually borrow money. So what you find is these bankers in Italy, they were the ones that funded the rise of Spain. They were the ones that loaned money to the Spanish. And it was the Spanish and the Portuguese who conquered the Americas. They were the ones that found lots of gold and silver there, and they became the first imperial powers in the rise of Europe. But financing Spain became a bit of a problem for these bankers, and that was the Spanish were too Catholic. They were anti-Semitic, they hated Jews, they hated Muslims. And remember, in the end of the 1400s, they were carrying out a genocide campaign against what remained of the Jews and the Muslims in Spain. So for these bankers, this was a bit of a problem. So what they did was, they loaned and financed Holland then. So that's why you find from the 1500s, Spain entered into a lot of wars with all the different European powers, and it declined as a power. But what these bankers did is they were creating money out of thin air. They would say, oh, this is backed by gold, but they would print loads of notes that here's a loan for you and you can come and redeem it for gold. But they were obviously printing notes well more than the gold that existed. And this is what allowed them to fund the rise of different European dynasties. Now, we have to remember that in Spain, they committed genocide against Muslims and Jews. So some of the Jews who were forced to leave from there, they went and joined these bankers. And they became part of the banking class. So what they did was they funded the rise of Holland, which replaced Spain. And then eventually they funded the rise of England and then even the rise of the US. Now, why this is all very important is in an era where gold and silver is money, having access to money in order to pay your troops, in order to buy weapons, that will decide who wins the wars, who doesn't win the wars. So what these international bankers, we should really call them, these goldsmiths who became international bankers, what they realized, they could determine the rise and fall of powers. They could determine the rise and fall of monarchies. They could decide the rise and fall of nations. So whoever would serve their interests, they would fund them. Whoever would want to become independent, they will fund somebody else. And then that monarchy would go to war with that particular monarch. So
the rise of finance, the rise of money actually is very, very central to the rise of Europe and what we have today. And this is why, you know, eventually, as you mentioned in your question, you saw the rise of the stock market, currency markets, and all of that's very important. But these bankers, goldsmiths who became international bankers, they were the ones that funded the rise of European powers. And then these European powers went and colonized the world and opened up the whole world. Because you got to remember, in the 1400s, 1500s, the Europeans believed Europe was the center of the world. They didn't even know America existed. They knew there was a China and an India, but it was a difficult getting there. Even the half of Africa hadn't been discovered at this point. So by the rise of these bankers who bankrolled a lot of this, this is how the world came to open up at the time.
So, Adnan, if these bankers were able to create money essentially out of thin air, why couldn't the monarchs do the same?
You're absolutely right. The monarchs should have done that, but the monarchs didn't actually understand how money works. And I would say it's much similar to today. Today, most people assume, and surveys have shown this, is the way money works is the banks take deposits, and then when you go to withdraw money, you're withdrawing what exists as a deposit. So the banks either have a balance sheet that matches, so you have deposits, money people put in, and then what we take out is money that people have put in. The other understanding people have is, people put money in the bank, and then what the bank does is it will, by times 5, 6, or 7, put that money out. What people don't understand, that's actually not how it works. Money is actually created out of thin air. There are surveys done on this. In fact, the number one study that you need to read about this is Professor Richard Warner. He has done the only empirical study on where does money come from in what the 5,000-year history of banking. And his conclusion at the end of his empirical research was money literally is created out of thin air. It literally is. And that was after he conducted his research. You've got to remember that the monarchs of Europe, how did they become monarchs? They inherited the role. They inherited the position. It wasn't on merit. It wasn't these guys had a good understanding of economics and foreign policy and geopolitics. What happened was, I'm a monarch. I've conquered lots of territory. I now call myself a king. And my oldest son will inherit this role. So that's why you find in history despotic kings. You find kings that are drunk or high most of the time. They've got no clue what they're doing. You got a lot of kings who just went to war for the sake of war. So these kings didn't understand that the way money works, they assumed money works by there's gold and silver. And when I want a loan, if the goldsmith doesn't have enough gold, he'll go and buy gold from somewhere else. So when he lends me the gold or lends me a note that says it's backed by gold, the assumption was, there's gold there. Like today, people assume the physical money exists in the bank when it doesn't. In fact, notes and coins form a very small amount of money in the bank. 97% of money in the bank is actually loans that are created out of thin air and given out. So the money you've got in your pocket actually is a loan that was given out to someone somewhere else. And this is how it exists at the time. So what the bankers did at that time, the monarchs could have easily done that, but the monarchs didn't understand this was how this was playing out. They didn't understand how money works. And I would say that's very similar to now. People don't actually understand how money works. So they just assume. In fact, many people think the government prints money. Mm. They actually assume governments print money when actually in the world, there's no government that actually prints money. Money is actually printed by the banks or printed by the central banks, which are completely independent to banks. So the reason why the monarchs took loans and then had to do something about repaying them is because they assumed only goldsmiths have money, and that's what money is.
So the Rothschilds family is surrounded by both history and mythology. How did they become one of Europe's most powerful banking families, and what was their actual influence on international finance?
For the financial system we have today, you can credit it or discredit it to the Rothschild family, the Rothschild dynasty. In fact, the financial setup we have of central banks, of lending, or borrowing and lending that we have, this goes back to the Rothschilds from the late 1700s, early 1800s. In fact, they established the origins of the financial system that we have, the way we work. In fact, most banks in some form or shape are owned by other older banks, and those older banks were established by the Rothschilds at the time. Now, the Rothschilds, or Meyer Rothschild, he emerged from Frankfurt in Germany. And Germany at that time was many different territories of different size, princes and monarchs fighting each other, fighting other powers. So what happened with the Rothschild was, being Jewish, Jews were the only ones that really engaged in money lending in the medieval period, because money lending wasn't allowed for Christians. It was seen as dirty. It was seen as unclean. So because the Jews were oppressed, they were second-class citizens. There was anti-Semitism was ripe throughout Europe. The Jews were the only one that engaged really in money lending, and all the monarchs and the princes, they needed money in order to go to war. So what happened with the Rothschild specifically is he lent some rare coins, or took care of the rare coins of a prince in Hanover, I think it was. And as a result, that got him contact with other princes who needed money. And probably the period that really made the Rothschilds who they are is when Napoleon was invading Europe. Many of these princes, they had to leave where they were because their money would have got confiscated, or they would have been effectively arrested by Napoleon. So what many of them did was they left their wealth with the goldsmiths. And in Germany, one of the biggest or growing goldsmiths was the Rothschilds. So that was where really the Rothschilds built their metal teeth. That was where literally they built the family name and they became what they were. The main difference, though, with the Rothschilds and every other goldsmith was the Rothschilds understood the unique role money creation was. They realized that they're at the center of this unique role of money creation, and they realized the difference they could make in shaping the world. So that's why the Rothschild dynasty, what they did was they wanted to create a particular type of world where central banks would lend to all countries around the world. And before this period, we never had this. We never had anyone thinking, let's create a bank for the whole world. What you had was Europe. You lived in Frankfurt. You lent to a local prince. It didn't go further than that. So what you find was in the early 1800s, when Napoleon was defeated, 1815, the Rothschilds wanted to set up a central bank that manages all the central banks in the world. However, what you find was the Russian Tsar and other leaders, they stood against this. It would take another century to develop central banks across the whole of Europe. So what the Rothschilds did was he had, I think, five or six kids. He sent his kids to set up banks in all the key European countries at the time. So you had Venice, you had Vienna, you had London, you had Berlin. And that effectively became a banking network. And because Europe was becoming the center of the world, well, if you're lending to European countries, you've now become an international banker. So the banking system we have today, that's actually its origins. That's actually where it came from. And because the Rothschilds were the ones that created it, it put them in a very unique position. So before the Rothschilds, you had goldsmiths who would lend to individual monarchs that they knew. The Rothschilds were creating money and lending money to countries who were building railways, who were colonizing the rest of the world, who were finding oil and then they needed money. So a lot of the key developments really in the 1800s and 1900s, a lot of it came from Rothschild's money. And that's why they had a big say on how the world evolved and turned out.
Another family that often comes up is the Rockefellers, who built an empire around oil and later expanded into many other fields. How influential have they been in shaping the world that we live in today?
So the Rockefeller is the other family. You've got Rothschilds on one end and you've got the Rockefellers on the other end, who have really shaped and defined the role that we live in. The difference between the Rockefellers from the Rothschilds is the Rockefellers originally emerged in oil. So we're in the late 1800s, early 1900s. We are just about to move from coal to oil. And John D. Rockefeller, what he did was, after borrowing money from the Rothschilds, he was the one that established America's oil industry. And he controlled everything. He controlled mining. He controlled refining. He controlled transport. He was ruthless in his methods. He had spies that would monitor his competition. He had spies who would sabotage what other people were doing. So by the early 1900s, he actually controlled 95% of America's oil. If you take your mind back, there were three sources of oil that created the oil industry as we know it. You had Russia, which the Rothschilds funded. You had Iran, which the British developed. And then you had America. These were the three original source of oil, which created the oil industry as we know it. But because of the way Rockefeller worked, John D. Rockefeller worked, because of how ruthless he was, he gained a lot of bad publicity, a lot of people turning against him. He was like a titan of America, one of the richest people in the world. And he was getting a lot of bad publicity. And he made a decision after advice from his consultants that, look, everyone's turning against you. In fact, antitrust action had begun from within Congress against John D. Rockefeller. So what he did was, is he went into what we call today philanthropy, where he would give money to good causes. And he did this in order to change his reputation. What also happened was the Standard Oil Company, which was his oil company, it was broken down into about 25 entities. So, you know, Conoco, all the main American oil companies today, they are descendants from Standard Oil. So his oil company was broken up and he was given, I think, 25% share. But the main thing was he went into philanthropy. And the first thing he went into was public health. What John D. Rockefeller did, and what subsequently his family's been doing, is they've poured money into public health. So, you know, dealing with tuberculosis, all those illnesses 100 years ago people were dying from that today we take for granted. If you look at the vaccines, if you look at the research, it all came from the Rockefeller family. So within 20 years, the Rockefellers completely changed the opinion about them. Originally, the Rockefeller family was this ruthless businessman who was sabotaging his competitors, and now he's giving away money. So his image completely changed.
And the world we live in today, the Rockefellers played a very key role.
And I'll just give you a couple of examples. The original studies into public health all started from institutes established by the Rockefeller family. The original research into eugenics, which humans should survive, which humans shouldn't survive because, you know, we don't like them, we don't like their color, or they're weak. This research started from Rockefeller Institutes and eventually then went on to the Nazis who tried to implement it. All the research into abortion, into sexuality, started from Rockefeller Institutes. In fact, the first research on homosexuality, on sexuality, which then, you know, justified, or from there came the discussion of homosexuality, in the 1940s, it was from Rockefeller Institutes, and they used, they call it the Kinsey scale. Yeah. And what that was, that they said that sexuality is fluid, i.e., it's not about man and a woman. A man can go with a man, a woman can go. This is in the 1940s. And what you find is the Rockefellers really took to heart that there's too many people in the world. How should we control the world population? And where does this idea come from? For at least 100 years, we've had this idea. There's too many people in the world. There's not enough resources. We're going to run out of resources. Lots of people are going to be in poverty. All of this opinion has come from Rockefeller-funded institutes, NGOs, and organizations. And that's why abortion, this becoming legalized in Europe, sexuality, all of this has come from Rockefeller institutes. The Rockefellers also were the key family that called for a move away from fossil fuels. So what's interesting is these guys made their wealth from oil. And from the 1950s onwards, they've been talking about going green. They've been talking about sustainability. They've been talking about we need to save the environment. So
what you find even today, a lot of the research that goes into sustainability, global population, the environment, all of this comes from Rockefeller Institute. So ideas such as peak oil, overconsumption, the climate debate, a lot of it really comes from them as well. So the Rockefeller family today exists in public health, in medical research, in finance, in IT. They've gone cross industries. And actually, they have shaped a lot of the ideas we have about green tech, about population and how much population there should be in the world. So they've come to dominate a lot of these industries, and that's how they've been able to shape the modern world that we're in.
So there are a number of organizations I want to ask you about, Adnan. Can you explain what they do and their role in the world? And the first one is Council of Foreign Relations.
So the Council of Foreign Relations is a think tank and research organization that's composed of American officials and global leaders. It was an informal group in the early 1900s, an informal group of about 150 people, you know, historians, political scholars.
They were brought together by President Woodrow Wilson after World War I in order for them to advise him on America's post-World War I policy. But what you find was this institute came to be dominated with people with connections to the J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, all of these sort of guys. And in fact, the Rockefellers even funded the headquarters for this organization. So today what you find is the Council of Foreign Relations is a think tank. It puts out research. Many of its senior researchers and officials end up going into the US government, end up going into international organizations and taking the key positions. And they, what they're famous for, Council of Foreign Relations, is their closed-door meetings with heads of state. So that's why many people believe these guys have a big say. And what these guys are saying is, you know, capitalism, the West is the dominant faction in the world. We should say how the world should be. We should determine how people should live. So the role it's come to really play is the ideas that the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers have always been promoting, that the West is the world and that's how they should live. So what Council of Foreign Relations also does, it puts out a lot of research looking at the problems we have in the world, and it provides solutions for them as well.
The next one is Trilateral Commission.
So the Trilateral Commission was founded in 1973 at the request of David Rockefeller. The Rockefeller family obviously comes up again and again. And this is supposed to be a non-governmental think tank that consists of around 300 members from North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Now, these regions were selected because they were considered the dominant areas of industrialization. They were the democracies of the world. And what it is, it's really a forum for business leaders and government officials and UN officials to discuss global issues. And obviously, when you're discussing global issues, the discussions you're having is amongst people who are experts, officials. They're going to be parts of government who implement these solutions. So the content of these meetings are really important. That shows you
it's what these world leaders and experts are talking about and thinking about and what they believe the solution should be.
Bilderberg Group.
So the Bilderberg Group was established in 1954 by the Prince of Holland, and it takes its name from the Hotel del Bilderberg, which was the first place where they had their meeting. And again, this is a private annual gathering of around 100 government officials, economic experts, and business leaders from Europe and North America. And this organization was developed during the Cold War period with a specific goal of understanding problems in the world and make sure there's a close relationship between Europe and the US. And you can imagine during the Cold War, Europe was the front and America was backing it. So again, this is, you know, a group of guys getting together who believe the world should look a particular way, and they can establish that world because they are world leaders.
The final one, World Economic Forum.
So the World Economic Forum was founded in 1971 by Klaus Schwab. I think recently he stepped down as being the leader. And the World Economic Forum, it seeks to shape global regional industry agendas and come up with solutions. So obviously the most famous thing they're known for is the Great Reset, that the global economy needs to be transformed, which they come up with during COVID. The other ideas they've come up with is stakeholder capitalism, where effectively the private sector should run countries rather than having central governments. The fourth industrial revolution, the next generation of technologies, which are going to be quite intrusive. They're calling for that and promoting that. And probably the two key things that they're really famous for is the abolition of private property. So I'm sure you've heard of the idea that you will own nothing and be happy. And then creating a digital system where everyone is digitally connected.
Now, all of these organizations we've spoken about, they're perfect if you're a globalist. If you believe the world should look a particular way, here are organizations that bring together the most important people in the world, and they talk and discuss how the world should be and how these solutions should be implemented. So they're not restricted by borders. They're not restricted by nations. These organizations transcend national borders. So when a leader from the UK goes to these meetings, he may be the leader for the UK, but the issue these people are talking about, these transcend borders. So, you know, the people who go to these meetings, people who run these organizations, they don't really believe in nation states. They really believe these borders should go. And if you look at many issues around the world, like climate change, you know, climate change isn't affected by borders. Climate change doesn't care about borders. And that's the common thing when you look at all these organizations.
So let's stick with the World Economic Forum. You've touched upon it. You mentioned the Great Reset. Now, this is something that was mostly talked about during the COVID-19 pandemic. What exactly is the Great Reset, and why has it generated so much debate?
So the Great Reset, which is probably the most famous thing the World Economic Forum's come out with, what it means is the current global economy that we have, so the consumption levels, fossil fuel use, and the level of population, it is not sustainable, and we need to transform and have a new global setup. That is a fundamental idea at the Great Reset. So we need to push the reset button and change the way we're living. So amongst the proposals, they're talking about totalitarian national grids, which we know now as the 15-minute smart cities. They're talking about central bank digital currencies, just get rid of money altogether. We have digital currencies, movement licenses, which we saw during COVID. And they're talking about a new social credit system where people are given a score based upon what they do, how they live, all of these things. Now, what's interesting with all of these, obviously, you're right. Since COVID, we've been hearing about these things. And it all sounds very communist. It all sounds very centralized. It all sounds very controlling. It all sounds basic things that you take for granted today, somebody else will be deciding. And that's why during COVID, it was announced and you've seen a lot of pushback against it. And what I find interesting with this discussion is the advocates for this are not hiding what they want to achieve. There's too many people in the world. We're having too many babies. That needs to stop. And they're talking about using vaccines in order to stop it. They're talking about controlling people. So if you have an opinion the state doesn't like, they will cut you off to your money. And if money is only digital, nothing you can do. They're actually being quite open that this needs to be done. And as I mentioned, these international organizations where people come together, they believe the world should look a particular way. And why should the world look the way they believe? Because they have loads of money. They believe they have a right to tell people how they live. And this goes back to the point I made at the beginning, power and control. This has never changed. No matter which empire we look at throughout history, power and control has always been central. And as I mentioned, the technology was the major obstacle. If you look at central bank digital currencies, if you look at smart cities, movement licenses, digital IDs, these are all technologies that allows you to control people. It allows you to define who can do what, when they can do it. And if they don't abide by the rules, they can be in trouble because all of this will be centralized and control will be centralized. So it all sounds very, very communist. It's taken quite a hit, to be honest with you. There's been a lot of opposition against it. However, the advocates of this are still talking about this. You've heard Keir Starmer not so long ago talking about digital IDs in the UK. In El Salvador and Nigeria, they've even tested central bank digital currencies and the response hasn't been great. So they're still trying to establish this architecture and there's a lot of pushback against it. And so that's what the Great Reset was. So it seems during COVID, they believe this was the opportune time to push it out. Because COVID's happening, you've got this major global catastrophe, and that they believed this is when people accept that we need to change things.
Let's stick to COVID-19. You know, it was one of the most significant events of our time. And it generated huge disagreements over everything from its origins to lockdowns to vaccines. And looking back, you know, 6 years later, what do we know now and what questions remain unanswered?
Well, what we know now is everything that was termed a conspiracy has turned out more or less to be true. I remember at the time, everybody was being labeled. If you challenged the official narrative, you were labeled as a conspiracist. So just from the theory on how it started, you had two theories. The lab leak theory, that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was experimenting with chemicals, with viruses, and it leaked out. And then the other theory is that there was an infected animal and it spread to a human and then it spread to the world. They're the two theories. Lab leak theory, and then the human theory. The lab leak theory for the first 3 or 4 years was considered a conspiracy. And I remember seeing lots of documentaries. Why do people believe in this theory? After 6 years, we still haven't found the first human who contracted it. And actually, the CIA are now officially saying the lab leak theory is most likely to be the correct theory. So that's interesting. That's a bit of a U-turn. The conspiracy now is being accepted by officials as the norm. Now, what probably didn't help at the time was the Chinese government, their attempt to cover up what had happened at this Wuhan Institute. They tried to cover up what happened. They even tried to cover up the number of deaths that happened at the beginning. They even deleted the databases that they had of the millions of samples they'd been testing. Now, all of this is really fishy. You've got an institute that's testing viruses, and you know, so many things can actually go wrong. And the Chinese went further, though. They imprisoned Chinese citizens who talked about it. They gagged scientists. They blocked any meaningful investigation regarding what had happened in Wuhan. They even sabotaged some of the equipment that would have given more of an insight into it. Now, I don't think there's any big conspiracy here. I think what the Chinese were doing, they didn't want to show weakness. That's what happened. However, you know, this... A global epidemic has been spoken about by a number of different individuals. But the key thing really is even today, we still don't know human number one, which is how these things are normally identified and studied from. So yeah, COVID happened. The origins remain murky and there are a lot of questions. But we've got to keep in mind so many things were implemented and justified on COVID. Lockdowns, you not being able to go meet your parents, some people not being able to access their money. Things like having masks, things like having people not being able to move from area to area. All of this is based on COVID. All of this is based on what happened at the time. And if there are question marks about the event itself, then this raises questions on everything that has come as a result of that in terms of these policies. And some of the policies that were implemented and are now trying to be expanded, these have been spoken about by certain individuals for a very long time. They were talking about implementing such policies in order to control people. So what this really shows us is during COVID, a number of policies were implemented that allowed for the control of large amounts of people that would not have been possible on a normal day. If you were told you can't go out, you got to wear a mask, nobody would accept that on a normal day. Due to COVID, these things were accepted and people stand against people who would question it. But 6 years down the line, I think there's very few issues around COVID where what was labeled conspiracy today has proven to be fact.
In the last 500 years, every era has its famous personalities, from intellectuals, leaders, and generals who called for a new world and necessary transformation. Now, I wanted to go through some individuals that get plenty of airtime in our era and where they fit in to the grand scheme of things. The first one being George Soros.
So yeah, George Soros has been around for a while. He's actually pretty, I think he's in his 80s or his 90s. What George Soros was famous for, well, you know, the color revolution that happened in Ukraine, in other Eastern European countries. He was a big backer of these. And what you find is Jules Soros' opinions are that we need to move away from the current system of borders and nation states. We need to move away from where there's one nation that's a hyperpower. What he advocates is there should just be one single global system, and it should be run by the private sector. It shouldn't really be run by governments. And what he does is he pulls a lot of money into democracy programs, into like third world countries that can be opened up and become ripe. Alongside that, he obviously makes a lot of money in terms of speculation and things like that. But Jules Soros, you know, he's been around for a while. He's considered a democracy promoter. He's considered someone who, you know, likes to speculate. He's become like a titan of capitalism. But he's a big advocate. And he doesn't hide this. He's a big advocate. No borders, no hyperpower, one single global system, which sounds very similar to this idea of one global government. This has been an idea of the Rockefeller Rothschilds going back 200-300 years. And what you find is other individuals have caught on to this, and they are also advocates of it as well. And Jules Soros is one of them.
The next one, Elon Musk.
So Elon Musk is a titan of our era. He's obviously not as old as Jules Soros. He obviously made his fame originally at PayPal. But what you find now, he's all about technocratic advancement. He has transhumanist goals. And actually, his main important drive at the moment is interplanetary expansion. He wants to expand to the moon. He wants to expand abroad. He actually wants to put data centers in space, because there's not enough energy on Earth for what we need in terms of power for AI. And so he's a big advocate of we should have technocratic governments. We should have experts from the private sector that run governments. We shouldn't really have civil servants, and we shouldn't really have our politicians. His transhumanist goals, he's been very open. He wants to put a microchip in your head. He wants to fuse the human with technology. And to be honest with you, this has been a wet dream of many megamaniacs throughout history. And now we've got the technology, and that's what you're seeing. So yeah, Elon Musk, really, I would say in many ways, he's, you know, you had John D. Rockefeller in the 1900s. He's that version of that today. He wants to see a particular world, and he's going to benefit from that particular world himself. And that's why he keeps advocating these solutions to the Trump administration and other governments.
Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, so Jeff Bezos, who's the owner of Amazon, he's all about technocratic consolidation. He's talking about a centralized food system. He's talking about the integration of surveillance technology into every aspect of daily life. And if this is achieved, he's going to be at the center of it. And again, like Elon Musk, he believes the private sector should run countries, should run governments. Politicians are useless. He's been a big advocate of food systems. So he talks about most of the protein coming from bugs. He rarely wants to decide what you should be eating, when you should be eating. And at Amazon, he's been working on the integration of surveillance technology into every aspect of life. So the Internet of Things, all of these sort of things, he's a big advocate of that. And the consistent pattern you see with some of these guys is the solution they're advocating, they will be at the center to benefit from this as well.
Donald Trump.
So Donald Trump, I wouldn't really put him in the same category as the guys we mentioned. He is further down the food chain. Again, he's America first. The country's going down the wrong way, and he believes the country should be run in a particular way. So he's come to power. He's advocating these America first policies. And let's not forget, at the same time, he's making sure his family and his pocket are benefiting from it as well. So we know the amount of money he's making out of cryptocurrency, things like that. The difference between Trump and the other guys we mentioned, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, Trump doesn't have some grand agenda. He doesn't have some grand transhumanist agenda. He's got these views about America first. He's got these views about America going in the wrong direction, but he doesn't really go beyond that. So although we're talking about him in this category, he's not really at the level of these guys we've spoken about.
Jeffrey Epstein.
So Jeffrey Epstein, see, as an individual, it seems he was a CIA asset. They built him to honey trap other individuals and get information that could be used against them if and when needed. The important thing about Jeffrey Epstein, it really highlighted how things work at the highest level. And there's a number of things we learned through this whole Epstein saga. We learned that there are some people who operate beyond national borders, beyond governments. They're even above that. They get access to everybody and everything. And that is the world a lot of these people are calling for. You know, for them, the government is for normal people. They work above that. I mean, yeah, he was a pedophile and he was abusing girls. But what the whole Epstein saga showed us is at this level, you know, nation states, national laws, these sort of things, they don't really apply to them.
Alexander Dugin.
So Dugin, he's obviously a renowned political philosopher from Russia. So he doesn't really fit into this global outlook with the guys that we've actually spoken about. He's more about the world should be organized by multiple great civilizations rather than one civilization or one power that dominates it. So this is the idea that Putin's been spreading. Now, what we should have is multiple powers in the world, multiple civilizations, so they balance each other out. So the ideas he's calling for, and obviously he's quite popular in Russia, it goes against the West and what these guys are trying to do. And we only know about him because of Putin and Russia. If Russia was not a power, we would never really heard about him. So yeah, he, although we're talking about him, he's not really the same camp as Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk and Epstein.
And finally, Bill Gates.
So Bill Gates really is the Rockefeller of the 21st century. Like John D. Rockefeller had to transition from oil to philanthropy, Bill Gates has done the same. What Bill Gates did in the 1990s when the internet was coming about, everybody was using Windows. And what Bill Gates did, he made sure all his competition would never get their apps or icons onto Windows. So I remember I grew up in the 90s, Netscape was the internet browser of choice. And what Bill Gates did was he made sure you only used Internet Explorer when you use Windows. But what happened was there was a lot of antitrust action against Microsoft. Microsoft was considered to have a monopoly. So what he did was, like John D. Rockefeller, he made the transition into philanthropy. His institute he set up with his ex-wife became the biggest philanthropy organization in history. It was about $35 billion. And what Bill Gates has done since then is he's made a life from vaccines. And what you find from Bill Gates, he has been screaming for at least 2 decades. And he's been trying to market that there's a big threat of a pandemic. And when a pandemic comes about, which is imminent according to his research, I've got the solutions on how we're going to solve it. And what was his solution? This is before COVID. His solutions were lockdowns, track and trace, vaccines, face masks. So when COVID happened, he was well placed to get his solutions implemented. And Bill Gates doesn't hide. He's never hidden what he believes the problem in the world is. His view is the problem in the world is there's too many people. He believes in the third world, they are expanding at a rate that is unsustainable. So he has said openly and numerous times, in fact, you can find a TED talk from 2010 where he said vaccines is the solution to deal with population growth. What that means is we should use vaccines to make sure people can't have babies. So what you've got here is an individual who has more money than he knows what to do. He believes he knows what's best for people, and he believes there shouldn't be too many people in the world. And he believes he has a solution for that, which is vaccines. So he is pouring money into research, into vaccines. He is telling everyone what the problems are, and he's telling them what the solution is, and then he has the actual tool that can solve it as well. So Bill Gates is a really good example of all those guys throughout history who lived for power and control and can decide how people lived. The difference between Cyrus the Great of Persia and Bill Gates is Cyrus the Great just never had access to technology that Bill Gates has today. That's really the difference between the two. But the underlying thing they both want to achieve is the same, which is, you know, domination.
And where does Israel fit into this discussion? You know, there are countless claims about Israel, Zionism, and Jewish influence in world affairs. How do we separate geopolitical reality from conspiracy and put these issues into their proper context?
So we need to separate between Jews, between Zionists, and between the Rothschilds. I think that's a good way to look at this discussion. So the Jews, I think the important thing to know is some of the more recent history. They obviously lived under they've been around for 3,000 years. They were expelled multiple times from their homeland. The last time was during the first century under the Romans. They were booted out from there, and that's when the diaspora came around. That's when Jews basically left and went to different parts of the world, and many of them came to Europe, and the Jewish diaspora came about. When they came to Europe, what they found was the Europeans absolutely hated them, and this all the way up to World War One. Europeans absolutely hated them. Europeans were anti-Semitic. Europeans forced them to live in ghettos. They had no rights. They had no way to engage. They even had no way to work. They weren't even, people refused to even work with them in the normal industries. That's why the Jews then went into money lending, because the Christians weren't allowed to do money lending, usually wasn't allowed by them. So that's how Jews came to dominate banking in Europe, because that was the only thing that they were allowed to do. Nobody else would do it because of the view in Christianity. And then we know the events that happened in the early 1900s. There was a call that the Europeans don't accept us. They're anti-Semitic. And the opinion among the Jews was, the best way for us to survive is we just live in our ghettos and live together as close as we can as Jews. This Zionist opinion that we should have our own homeland, this was a very fringe opinion in the middle to late 1800s. In fact, when the Zionists went to their own scholars, their rabbis, the rabbis were completely against them having their own nation, because you've got to keep in mind that, you know, Jews, are they a religious grouping or are they a racial grouping? And depending on who you talk to, you get different views. Throughout history, Jews viewed themselves as not brothers and sisters as we do as Muslims. The way they see it, as an Australian Jew is an Australian. A European Jew is a European Jew. We may believe in the same religion, but as a people, you are based on where you come from. So that's why you find you've had different types of Jews for our history. And that's why when Zionism first came about, the support amongst the European Jews was very little. So obviously, the Brits supporting the call for a state for the Jews, that gave a bit more credence to Zionism. And we've got to keep in mind that a lot of Zionists weren't even Jews. You don't need to be a Jew, actually, to be a Zionist. If you believe Jews should have their own country, that makes you a Zionist. And there's a lot of support from non-Jews, especially in America, as you see it. The Rothschilds... Sorry, before we go to the Rothschilds, another thing we've got to keep in mind, that there are Jews who were able to make it to high office. Jews who became very influential throughout Europe, they actually looked down upon many of their Jewish brothers and sisters. Because Jews lived in ghettos, Jews were disliked, they were hated. All things that happened in Europe, like the plague, was blamed on Jews. So you had Jews who would make it to high office, they would actually look down upon the Jews. So to give an example of this, Lord Balfour, who did the Balfour Declaration, and then you had Lord Palmerston, who made that famous statement about not having permanent allies and permanent friends. Both of these were Jews, but they absolutely hated their Jewish brothers and sisters. Lord Balfour's support for Jewish homeland, one of the reasons he did that, he wanted the Jews to leave Europe. They looked down upon them. So Then you got the Rothschilds as well, yeah? And the Rothschilds themselves, they looked down upon their Jews. Their support for a Jewish homeland wasn't for poor Jews from Europe to go there. They only wanted Jews who were educated and who were well off to actually go there. Now, the reason why I mention this history is I think to say the Jews are this and the Jews do that, that's a very generic brush. The Jews are not one monolith. I mentioned Jews, Zionists, and Rothschild. These are two different things. And in fact, the Rothschild support for Israel and many British officials who supported Israel, their support for it wasn't for, you know, we're Jewish. It actually was for the Jews to leave Europe and actually go there as well. So throughout most of medieval history, because Jews took up the jobs that were only available to them, and they took up jobs that the Europeans refused to do, they came to dominate finance. And from there, they were able to fund some of the princes and the monarchs that used to go to war with each other. And that's how they were able to become influential. And from amongst them, you've got the Rothschilds, who really reached a level where they could actually say who comes to power, who doesn't come to power. So, you know, I think sometimes this discussion is really generic, where Jews get labeled with lots of stuff. There's a bit more nuance to this discussion. And actually, when you start breaking it down, there's a lot more to it. And actually, not all Jews are the same. It's like saying all the Muslims are the same. They're not. There are differences amongst them, the different madahibs, their different views, and the Jews are the same as well.
Adnan, I want to ask you about some corporations. The first one being BlackRock.
So BlackRock is the world's largest asset manager. They oversee trillions of dollars in assets on behalf of their clients. So that means they are major shareholders in all the major corporations in the world. That also means that is a huge concentration of ownership. You've got one organization who owns or has large stake holdings in all the large companies in the world. This means that they're in a very influential position. They decide which company survives, which company doesn't. And it also has made BlackRock very close relations with governments around the world, because they own or have part ownership in all these key companies. So that's why BlackRock comes up very, very regularly. And it's quite unique for a company to manage so many assets. In many ways, BlackRock is more rich, has more wealth than many countries in the world. So this places them in a very, very unique position. They can, you know, if you're a shareholder in the top 100 companies, well, governments need to come and talk to you. You can decide which direction the whole economy should go because you own the key companies that's going to be producing goods in those countries.
The next one being Palantir.
So Palantir is a data analytics company. It's a pretty recent company. It's become quite popular. And what you find is their customer base includes federal agencies, state and local governments, international organizations, and private companies as well. Now, Palantir believes in expanding government surveillance through artificial intelligence and facial recognition systems. And that AI and facial recognition system is what they make. They make the software for it. And probably what's quite worrying is their manifesto argues that the era that we're in is ending, and that technology companies should once again become closely integrated with national defense and industrial strategy. What they're saying is government should just outsource what they do to private companies like them. And this has given rise to the idea of techno-nationalism, the idea that technological innovation should be directed towards strengthening the power security of a nation rather than a company remaining politically neutral and being consumer-focused. So in their manifesto, they talk a lot about making America strong. Doing surveillance. So if you look at DEI in America, who are going around catching people and deporting them, Palantir has played quite a central role in that. So Sadiq Khan recently refused to give him a contract for London. And I think even the NHS, actually, they use Palantir software. So because of Brexit and the use of data, this company has actually become really, really popular. But what they're effectively doing is they are becoming an arm of the government. And they are creating software that actually does things which has very little oversight. And effectively, you're outsourcing it to the private sector. So they get a big say in how society will be going forward.
And the final corporation, Meta.
So Meta is important from the perspective the original product was obviously Facebook, and Facebook still today has the most accounts, has the most users. And we know Facebook has cancelled people, it's cancelled certain opinions, it's restricted access to Facebook when there's a revolution going on. So Meta is very important in the current context that we're in. And all of these companies, if you look at them, they effectively are very small organizations, concentrated ownership, who have a big say over how people communicate and what they see. And that's what makes them really, really important.
So, John, I want to ask you about your views on some conspiracies. So if you can briefly give your opinion, that'd be appreciated. Why is the assassination of JFK still an issue today?
It's still discussed today because this was, you know, it's recorded. We saw, well, I wasn't there, but we can see the video of JFK being assassinated when he was shot. So this is the American president. He was a youngish president. He was really, really popular, and he got assassinated. So there's always been a lot of conspiracies around it. Also, I don't think the CIA and American officials helped themselves because there was a lot of deflection. A lot of them wanted to hide their failures of this. Probably the key thing to understand is, look, the JFK actually had a lot of enemies. He had a problem with Israel because Israel was developing nukes and he stood against that. So he had a problem with Israel. So from an Israeli perspective, him being assassinated wasn't necessarily a bad thing. He had a problem with his own military because the military and the CIA tried to do an invasion of Cuba, which went completely wrong. And he, JFK, when he came in, he completely stopped any counter coup or counter attempt to go to Cuba again. So he had fallen out with the military as well. And then the other problem that happened was when he came to power, he couldn't believe the amount of money that was going into nuclear weapons. He couldn't believe this nuclear race with the Soviet Union, how much money was being spent, taxpayers' money. So this led to a run-in with the defense companies as well. So from that perspective, there's a lot of people who would have liked him to have gone. You know, he had a lot of enemies. And also he was very popular. He was a youngish president. His communication skills were really, really good. And because there's not been straight answers till today, this is why I think it still remains an issue of topic or an issue of discussion in conspiracy circles.
Adnan, do the Freemasons control the world?
So the Freemasons is the largest and oldest gentleman's fraternity in the world. They actually came back during the Enlightenment period. So this was a period where religious superstition was dominant. When the Enlightenment happened, a lot of organizations emerged in order to promote science and promote thinking. They're all about binding members together through shared experience. And what's happened is, over the years, American officials, American presidents, when they were younger, they were all part of this gentleman's club. And that's where this idea comes from. Oh, if a few presidents come from these organizations, then there must be something about this organization. And that's why this, you know, the thing about the Freemasons controlled the world keeps going around.
What is the occult all about?
Okay, so the occult literally means hidden. It refers to the study of mysterious beliefs, hidden knowledge, or inner enlightenment that can only be understood after years of study. Now, occult-based groups, yeah, you can't really separate them from secret societies. They're really secret societies that emerge during the Enlightenment. And what you really see about these people, you know, symbols and some ideas about knowledge, which, you know, isn't considered normal. So these are usually secret organizations. I remember when Queen Elizabeth passed away, you saw a lot of symbols and terms used, but more importantly, her whole funeral was very high in symbols that are, you know, norm for occultish type behavior and occultish type of thinking. And because these groups are secret, yeah, that's why people think there's a bit more going on here. You know, they're shaping events, they're doing things as well. There's not a lot of evidence for this, but because they're quite secret, that's why, you know, this issue keeps coming up.
The Illuminati.
So the real Illuminati, they were originally called the Perfectibilis, founded in 1976, is a group dedicated to the mutual aid, intellectualism, and philosophical free thought at the time, and in order to change society by influencing the move of the Shakers of the world. So, yeah, the term's quite negative, but actually, originally what it was, let's move away from religion, and how do we help individuals to think rationally, to use science and things like that? And obviously, because they've got their own initiation ceremonies, it's quite secret, that's given rise to, okay, these guys, you know, have a say in how the world runs. And I think some influential individuals, leaders, have been part of them when they were growing up. So from there, the idea comes that these guys control the world.
The establishment.
So the establishment is a broader term. It's about people who have economic interests and they have a common mentality. So to give you the example in the UK, the relationship Britain has with Israel, Britain should have nuclear weapons. Britain is center-right, not on the left. And its relationship with America, this is the establishment view. So what you find is not just the leaders. You find, if you look at the main news channels, if you look at the main presenters, if you look at the intellectuals in the UK, they are shocked when you say, get rid of nuclear weapons. They are shocked when you say, let's have a relationship with Russia rather than with America. So the establishment is a general term of those guys who have economic interests, so they want to maintain the current status quo, but they also have a common mentality, common outlook about things as well. So yeah, every nation has its establishment. So, you know, if you're a new leader running for office, the question is, are you part of the establishment or not? Do you subscribe to the common mentality or are you bringing something different? So definitely we can say Jeremy Corbyn was a part of the establishment. He did have economic interest, wasn't that rich, but also his views are very, very different compared to the normal views of the establishment.
9/11.
So there's always, I think now the mainstream view is that the official version isn't correct. I remember if you questioned the original version after 9/11, you were a conspiracy guy, you're a conspiracy theorist. Now, believing the initial view is wrong is the mainstream view. In fact, the conspiracy view now is if you believe the government view of a couple of guys got on a plane and they crashed into these buildings. I think with 9/11, look, what you've got to keep in mind is 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. America was a global unipolar nation. And throughout the 90s, they were looking at how are we going to make the 21st century the American century? There was no enemy. There was a big gap between America, the number one nation, and everybody else. So they even thought about China. Is China the enemy? Should we get ready for China? But China was a nobody, really, in the 1990s. And during this period, you saw the emergence of the neocons. And the neocons' view was that because of the Cold War, we had to, you know, promote international law, global institutions, in order to get the world together to fight the Soviet Union. Soviet Union is gone now. So their view was, now we can do what we always wanted, which is, let's dominate the world. Let's use our power to be the dominant power and forget international law, forget all of these things. And all their research and reports were talking about expanding America's military, being unilateralist. But what they found was, is if you've just won the Cold War, why are you expanding militarily? So what the neocons concluded was, is unless there's a Pearl Harbor type event, the public won't accept this. Now, Pearl Harbor was the event that officially led America to join World War II, but prior to that, they weren't going to join. And so then 9/11 happened, right? And then we know what's happened after that. Iraq was justified on 9/11. The Afghan invasion was justified on 9/11. In fact, everything America's done was justified on 9/11. So rather than being a conspiracy, what you see is, you know, the 9/11, the event itself, has been utilized to achieve lots of other political ends. And you can still get the report today, the Project for the New American Century. That's the one where the neocons say that the public won't accept this strategy unless there's a Pearl Harbor style event. They actually say in that report, which is available online, and then obviously 9/11 happened and we saw what they did. So I think that's the context of 9/11 we need to keep in mind.
What about jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS?
Okay, so I wouldn't put them in the group, all these other things we've started. I mean, the key thing with jihadis or people that go abroad and fight, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, America, Saudi, Pakistan funded, supported, trained and armed the Mujahideen to go into Afghanistan and defeat the Soviet Union. So America, Pakistan, Saudi knew who these guys are. They organized all these guys. They organized transport for people across the world to come and come and fight in Afghanistan. When the Afghan war finished, some of these guys then went to Chechnya to go and fight over there. Others went back to Saudi, like Osama bin Laden, and realized that Saudi Arabia is actually a sellout. It's not really Islamic, so then they turned against them. And then we find throughout the 90s, you know, bombings would go off against American targets in places like that. So all the whole war on terror is against individuals that you armed, funded, and created. So the fact that America didn't know 9/11 was going to happen, the fact that American targets are being taken out, it raises a lot of questions, because you were the ones that created these guys. You know who these leaders are. You know what they're all about. And then from that point onwards, you mentioned ISIS. All of the ISIS leadership was in Camp Bakka, south of Baghdad during the Iraq War. All of these guys were let out and they went on to become the leaders of ISIS, and they went into Iraq, took it over, and then they went into Syria. And today, Ahmad al-Sharaa is the leader of Syria. So it begs a lot of questions here. You know, this hasn't something that's come out of the blue. I just found it very interesting that ISIS would go across the border from Iraq into Syria. America's surveillance technology is there. American transport is there. America could see this happening and they didn't do much. They allowed ISIS to move from Iraq into Syria. They didn't do anything until they went to the north of Syria and started fighting the rebel groups. And then eventually America with the Kurds then started fighting against ISIS once they'd gone and messed up the whole revolution in Syria. So when we're talking about jihadis, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, this is more of a government policy discussion. The other points we discussed are more about what's going on around the world, the elites, what's their agenda. With the jihadi, this is more government, the global powers, an agenda they did to achieve their goals.
Interesting. Adnan, I feel like we've covered, you know, so many things today. But from a geopolitical perspective, how should people think about everything that we've discussed today? You know, how do we put all this into its proper context?
So in our previous podcast, we talked a lot about how the world works, styles of means, following the nations. In our first one, Geopolitics 101, we built some other principles. The discussion we've had today is also part of that whole topic, because without this, you've got an understanding of the world, but you've not understood the other things that are going on. And whilst previously we talked about frameworks and styles and means and concepts, here the important thing is to understand the agenda these people have, because they've got the power, they've got the influence, they've got the wealth in order to achieve it. So if we want to make sense of the world, we need to understand who the powers are. We need to understand what they're doing. We also need to understand who the elites are and what's their agenda and how they work. And that's hopefully what we've done in this podcast. So we have to be aware of these things because they play a role in the world. And what you have to be aware of is what is their agenda. So I would say to believe in no conspiracy is as bad as saying everything's a conspiracy. Yeah, hopefully that makes sense. That, in fact, we've talked about 9/11, we talked about COVID. All the conspiracies at the time have now turned out to be true. And by knowing their agenda and how they want to achieve it, that then allows you to understand what is actually going on. And COVID was a good example of this. If we take away COVID happened, but if you look, Bill Gates was talking about a pandemic well before COVID. Bill Gates was talking about how to deal with a pandemic well before it happened. When COVID happened, we saw policies that I'm sure people will look back in the future, when they look back at history, they would be like, in their mind, it would be unbelievable that you were in lockdowns. Whole economies shrunk because of these lockdowns. And what COVID for me revealed, it showed in live format what the agenda of these elites are. Their agenda is more centralization. Their agenda is more control. Their agenda is even controlling the way you think and how you view things. And the reason why they want to do it is because they believe they know better than you do on how the world should be and how you should be living. And they've got the wealth in order to achieve it. In fact, they've got more money than they know what to do. So this is why for them, for people like Bill Gates, it's not about money. Although they make money out of this, it's not about earning more money. They've got more money in the world. What they want to do is control everyone in the world, how they live and how they think. And that is nothing new. You go back to the time of, you go back to ancient times, individuals wanted to do it. You go back to medieval times, individuals wanted to do it. The difference today is the technology is available to someone mad enough who wants to achieve this. And that's why this discussion in this context is really important if we want to have a broad understanding of what's taking place.
Adnan, as always, thank you so much for your time today. To our listeners, if you want to learn more about the issues raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com, which is all one word. You can also learn more about other issues by accessing our website, where you will find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Imran. Thank you for listening.